Putting Forests First, Ecological Forestry and an Ethical Worldview by David Foster. Editor's note from Liz Thompson. David Foster, Tony D'Amato, and Brian Donahue have collaborated to introduce a series of ecological forestry articles in this issue. David's introduction follows perfectly from Susie O'Keefe's essay in our last issue and David Marvin's here, as well as from Rick Morrill's piece in this series. Reminding us of Aldo Leopold's message, David Foster calls on us to adopt an ethic of humility in forest management, to acknowledge that management serves human needs rather than nature's needs. Nature will be fine without us, but we need forests. Managed forests are part of the integrated approach to conservation that we support, and managing them with care and humility will go a long way toward healing past damage.
Putting Forests First, Ecological Forestry and an Ethical Worldview by David Foster. Let us adopt a forest ethic. Let us approach forest ecosystems with the respect that their complexity and beauty deserve. Let us approach the forest with appropriate humility. Jerry Franklin, 1989, Towards a New Forestry. Forests have intrinsic value independent of our needs and wants. We need forests, but the truth is, they don't really need us. Rick Morrill, 2025, The Practice of Ecological Forestry. So, what is ecological forestry? It has been called a strategy, a framework, a toolbox, and a philosophy. The term was first applied in the 1940s by Harvard forest silviculturalists Stephen Spur and Albert Klein, who joined together ecology and forestry to advance practices that, quote, follow nature as much as possible. Subsequently, the term has been argued as following four principles: continuity, complexity, timing, and context. It's also been argued that FSC certification signifies these principles in practice. Meanwhile, many articles in this issue of From the Ground Up characterize ecological forestry by aspirational goals: diversity, complexity, resilience, integrity, and health. But does anything unify these different descriptions? What all advocates seem to agree on is that ecological forestry is not traditional forestry or, quote, old forestry. That is why Jerry Franklin chose, quote, new forestry, once he learned that Spur and Klein had already employed his favorite alternative. To Franklin, new or ecological forestry represented a new forest ethic, harkening back to Aldo Leopold's call for a land ethic in a Sand County almanac. To me, herein lies the essence of ecological forestry. It is not simply a toolbox or a set of ecological principles, but rather it is the moral grounding and worldview that helps guide how these may best be used. For as Chelsea Battaglia and Michael Nelson remind us in their critique of ecological forestry, without ecological grounding, we are left with, quote, a problematic range of variability in how it can be applied, end quote. After all, a clear cut, a selective thinning, and a wilderness will each have some analog in nature. And certainly each will have ecological consequences, and each may support great diversity. To know which is, quote, good, requires an ethical or a normative basis for judgment. Or as wildlife biologists Dick DeGraff and Malcolm Hunter have reminded me on occasion, there is no definition of what is good or healthy wildlife habitat without specifying the intention, the purpose, and the focal species involved. Every treatment of the land creates great habitat for something. Without ecological and ethical underpinnings and clear norms, positive-sounding goals such as diversity, sustainability, and health will, as Batavia and Nelson warn, cycle in a quick and predictable pattern from broad appeal to overuse to practical obsolescence. The ethics of ecological forestry. So what is the new ethic underlying ecological forestry? Traditional forestry is anthropocentric and utilitarian. It focuses on the management of forests as natural resources for human desires and ends. It is rooted in a worldview based on the inherent value of at least some humans and the instrumental value of nature to humans. For me, the new ethic is ecocentric and captured well by Rick Morrill's piece and his quote above. Nature has intrinsic value. We need nature. It does not need us. Forests and all life have value independent of their relationship to human needs and desires. As David Marvin notes in his piece, this embrace of the essential value and purpose of all biota recognizes that humans are not dominant, but are only part of an intricate web of life, death, evolution, and growth that is yet to be fully understood. To Mitch Lansky and Sam Brown, who write as well in this issue of From the Ground Up, this respect for all life guides low-impact forestry, a way of managing forests as if the future of both the forests and society mattered. It has been argued that this embrace of nature's moral standing has a deep history and ongoing presence in most indigenous cultures. So why an ethic? Some have argued that ecological forestry may not need ethics. And yet, a need for ethics is recognized throughout the forestry profession, albeit not always in harmony. The Society of American Foresters has a decidedly human-centric code of ethics that focuses on the rights of and responsibilities to humans and society. The land serves that end. And here's a quote. Foresters have a responsibility to manage land for current and future generations, to maintain the long-term capacity of the land to provide the variety of materials, uses, and values desired by landowners and society. End of the quote. In contrast, the ethical values espoused by the Forest Stewards Guild center on nature and the responsibility to sustain it. Citing nature as the guide, it also harkens back to Stephen Spurr and Al Klein. And here's a quote from the Forest Steward Guild ethics. The forest has value in its own right, independent of human intentions and needs. Our first duty is to forests and their future. The natural forest provides a model for sustainable resource management. Therefore, responsible forest management imitates nature's dynamic processes and minimizes impacts. And then finally, the Forest Service Employees for Environmental Ethics is a group that seeks to advance an ethic for resource management that centers the responsibility of public agencies and their employees on nature. And here's a quote from their ethical framework. We believe that the land is a public trust to be passed with reverence from generation to generation. The Forest Service and other public agencies must follow the footsteps of Aldo Leopold, a pioneer of conservation, and become leaders in the quest for a new resource ethic. End of that quote. I would argue that this ecocentric ethic also lays the foundation for integrated efforts like wildlands, woodlands, farmlands, and communities. Recognition of the inherent value in all life guides active management for woodlands and demands that we passively manage as much forest as possible as wildlands. It also informs the way we farm land and produce foods, as espoused by Conrad Vispo in this magazine in his earlier article called Thoughts on Farming With and for Nature. Most importantly, as many authors in this issue recognize, this ecocentric ethic should shape the way we live our lives, treat human relationships, and plan our communities. The report, Beyond the Illusion of Preservation, highlights the interconnectedness of these relationships. By minimizing consumption, we can establish more and larger wildland reserves and meet our timber needs. Surrounding reserves with well-managed forests and farmlands enhances the connectivity of nature with well-planned communities that benefit nature and society. In similar fashion, proponents of low-impact forestry seek to ingrain its ethics in our culture, arguing, as does David Marvin, that if society is not sustainable, then forest management cannot be. The application of ecological forestry. Nature has value. It does not need us. There has been and will be a world without us. When it comes to forest, this ethic has many ramifications. Embrace of its intrinsic value brings moral standing to and respect for nature and its capacity for self-management. Forests are self-regulating and can persist without human intervention. Given this, our first stance in management should be to leave nature alone. Instead of asking how we can employ our knowledge to help the forest, we might ask what we can learn by leaving it intact. Instead of questioning how many wildlands are enough, we might ask how much human impact on the world is enough. The value and self-regulation we recognize in nature are essential to our understanding of wildlands. Wildlands, or as they're also called, wilderness and forest reserves, are not untouched by humans, but rather are untrammeled landscapes that humans have chosen to leave alone. They are places where nature is permanently granted free will, unconstrained by human activity. Wildness is a process, not a product. It does not exclude humans, but is free from purposeful intervention. The embrace of passive management is also based on humility. It acknowledges all we do not know and helps to ensure that the parts and processes we do not even recognize will persist. Humility must also be a cornerstone of active management. We are constantly learning. Every management action we take is an experiment, based on imperfect knowledge and best conducted with restraint. Restraint because actions in our brief line will shape for us, in our brief life, will shape for us for generations. Walk the New England landscape today and witness the enduring legacies of Henry Thoreau's contemporaries. But what of our benevolent actions to help the forest? These, I would argue, are largely anthropocentric, self-serving, or justifications for other ends. The only reason to manage nature is for the products we need to sustain ourselves. Ecological forestry should seek to do that while minimizing those impacts. Our need for wood products, even if greatly reduced to minimize our footprint on Earth, will provide plenty of opportunity to practice ecological forestry. We do not need to invent other reasons to manage actively. Take resilience. Nature's resilience is apparent. Half of New England forests today develop with no help on farmland where most native species had been erased. Witness the flourishing of wildlands on degraded industrial lands managed by the Appalachian Mountain Club or the wilderness regions of the White Mountains. Forest resilience is one of the world's great environmental stories. Yet some invoke resilience to justify intervention, to favor certain species, or to speed a process, or simply to prove our own worth. Or take, reduce risk and minimize vulnerabilities. What do we fear? A hurricane? Disease or insects? Death is at home in a healthy forest. Natural disturbance is a great source of diversity. Yet we seek to diversify stands or landscapes by applying tree death in our own prescriptive ways. Why not just let nature do it? Why seek to minimize windthrow or infestation in one stand, yet diversify with silviculture in another? It is we who fear the impact and risk, not nature. We seek control in an uncertain future. We seek to improve forest health by killing trees by the thousands. Most of our fears for the future are not about the forest itself, but about the values we cherish, about the impact that forest disturbance may have on us. Climate will impact forests, but they will be fine. We fear damage to infrastructure, to quality timber, to the aesthetics that we value, and to our ability to go out and manage our woods. Let's be honest with the woods and ourselves. Manage lightly to secure products we need and no more. Leave the rest alone. That is the best help that we can give to nature. I'll close with two thought experiments. The first was originally advanced by Michael Nelson and is quite relevant today. Consider how different a world is when all human beings are granted intrinsic value, compared to one where some are only instrumentally valuable. Think of the institutions that cannot be tolerated in the former. For example, slavery, colonialism, and genocide. Now apply this logic to nature as well. The second is a simple question. How would you help the forest in the following photographs? The three images that I've included in this article all come from the Pisgah Forest, purchased in the 1920s by Harvard University to serve as a laboratory for the study of natural forest dynamics and as a guide to natural or ecological approaches to forestry. The first image shows the Pisgah Forest, this old-growth forest in 1916. The caption says, "This forest is magnificent and filled with towering 300-year-old trees." But it was dominated by two species, white pine and hemlock, forming an even-aged overstory above an understory and ground cover of low species diversity. Sitting on a ridgeline, it had just witnessed the removal of chestnut trees by blight and was clearly vulnerable to wind and to pathogens. Harvard Forest Director Richard Fisher led an effort to protect this forest from logging and to preserve it as a natural laboratory for the study of natural patterns and processes. The next picture shows the same forest in 1942. The caption there says, "This old-growth forest was laid flat by the 1938 hurricane and represented an extreme fire hazard to the eyes of local and state fire authorities, who insisted that it should be harvested." Yet the director, Al Klein, refused, stating that, quote, "The prostrate stand was in every sense as much a virgin forest as the pre-existing old-growth forest, white pine, and hemlock," end quote. The final picture shows the Pisgah Forest today, and the caption says, "This is a thriving forest, but one of relatively low diversity. Its canopy, like many second-growth forests that recovered following the hurricane, is quite unremarkable, composed of two age classes of similar-sized trees, yellow, black, and paper birch and red maple that grew up following the hurricane, and then an older cohort of hemlock and beech that were highly suppressed in the understory of the old-growth forest before it blew down. White pine, which was dominant for 30 years in this forest and created an overwhelming overstory, is now represented by a single stem on 20 acres. Red oak is quite uncommon. Yet the lack of diversity in the living forest is completely forgotten in the splendor of physical structures that are in this forest but missing across most of New England, because our region lacks old-growth forests. 85 years after the hurricane, the forest now supports as high a density of downed wood as any forest in New England, with intact boles stretching across 100 feet in length and 2 feet or more in diameter, and uproot mounds from the previous overstory of hemlock and white pine 3 or 4 feet in height.